This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream, in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Could Belfast now get a consolation prize, even though we now know that four or five matches aren't going to be played at the Euros in 2028 at Casement Park? But even the Windsor Park is too small to host games. Could UEFA do us a favour and say, OK, you can have one game, even though the stadium is very small? Well, the sports minister, Gordon Lyons, is on the show saying, yeah, he's going to put that idea to UEFA, and he hopes they're going to say yes. Let's see. We also talk about Hugh Edwards on the programme and that sentence handed down to him yesterday in London. He wasn't sent to jail. Was it too lenient? Was it because he's a high-profile figure? We talked to legal experts who say no, that was a fair sentence. We talked to someone else who disagrees. We also talk this very sunny Tuesday about the weather. It's more than 20 degrees in places like Strabane and Enniskillen. The Nolan Show always brings you sunshine, especially today.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, it's Mark Simpson in the hot seat today, and it is hot. 20 degrees it's going to be in Belfast today, 21 degrees in Enniskillen and Strabane. Lucky them. Right, it's time to cool down. Let's get the 9 o'clock news.
Good morning, I'm Gráinne McKinney. Nurses who were forced to leave an Antrim housing estate in July after racist intimidation spent several weeks living in a hospital with their children. Three of the eight families who fled the Ballycraigie estate lived in the disused building in White Abbey Hospital for about 2 months. The housing executive told the nurses, who are originally from Africa, that because they were on temporary visas, they could not get emergency accommodation. It has told BBC Spotlight it can't offer what it called immigration advice. Takura Makoni from the African and Caribbean Support Network said the nurses had come here to care for patients.
If suddenly today, every single healthcare worker from another country was to go back to their country, are you telling me these lads who are throwing bricks into the windows are going to get jobs as nurses and start taking care of their own mums and nans? Because they won't do it. They won't do it for nothing, and they won't do it for a paycheck. That's why people are getting on planes to come and do those jobs.
Spotlight Summer of Shame will be available later on the iPlayer. It's also on BBC One Northern Ireland at 10:40 tonight. Leaking pipes have caused £4 million worth of damage to the acute mental health inpatient centre in the Belfast Health Trust. BBC News NI understands that water dripping from the pipes over 2 years has damaged walls and floors. The health regulator has issued an enforcement notice over other safety aspects in the building. The Belfast Trust said the construction team who built the facility have worked on a number of health projects and that the pipework will be replaced as part of a phased refurbishment programme. The East Belfast MP, Gavin Robinson, has said that the government should not intervene to save the troubled shipbuilder Harland & Wolff if the company can find a new private owner. The business has been placed into administration for the second time in 5 years, but Mr Robinson said he would want the government to step in if the East Belfast yard was at risk of asset stripping.
Government should not be considering committing public resource, public money, if the market has the appetite and the market is prepared to do it. But I say that as one point, recognising that one, I would like to see greater interest, and two, and though I do not think it is the case in this instance, I would expect the government to take steps if we felt that somebody was coming in to rip up the yard or to asset strip.
Universities in England are looking for what they called a reset with the government on the level of student tuition fees and maintenance loans. Fees in England have been capped at £9,250 since 2017. Universities UK says an increase in line with inflation is needed to prevent a slide into decline. Significant damage has been caused to a house in North Belfast after a car crashed into the front of the building last night. Police and firefighters were called to the scene in Blackdam Close shortly after 10 o'clock. No injuries were reported. With the weather, here's Jeff Maskell.
The overnight cloud breaking up and clearing north this morning to leave a dry, bright and sunny day with highs in the west of 21 or 22 degrees. Staying dry with clear skies tonight. Cooler tonight with temperatures dropping to lows of 7 to 9 Celsius with a chance of mist and fog forming in some sheltered areas. Now that will burn back early on Wednesday morning at the start of another sunny day. Daytime temperatures again breaking the 20 degree mark tomorrow. Staying fine, warm and dry for the rest of the week.
BBC News.
My goodness, what a day it's going to be. More than 20 degrees in some places. We're definitely having a September summer. But whatever you're going to do today, keep your radio on because we have a lot to talk about, including the latest developments at Casement Park. The Euros are gone. We know that. That's a certainty. And some people are still very upset about that. But what is it going to mean for Casement Park now? Well, it no longer needs the high-tech requirements of a UEFA stadium. So what do they want? Well, GAA fans are probably shouting at their radios at the moment. It's simple. Give us the ground we already have got planning permission for. It was 3 years ago, back in 2021. Remember this? The then Infrastructure Minister, Nicola Mallon, gave approval for a new stadium on the existing site with room for 34,500 fans.
I have no doubt that the GAA, like myself and many, many others, are keen that we see this built as quickly as possible so that we can see Gaels of all ages being able to play in this iconic stadium.
Iconic. That meant it included not just a new pitch and new floodlights, but a bar, a restaurant, conference facilities, training facilities, community spaces, education spaces, use of the stadium for up to 3 outdoor music concerts in any calendar year. Did anybody say Taylor Swift? So that has all been approved. It was approved 3 years ago. And many people thought, well, that's just simply what the GAA will now go back to. But listen to this. This is what the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, said yesterday.
What exactly is the new design going to look like? What might people be able to contribute? I'm keen that we take that work forward as quickly as possible. But now is not the time to pledge a sum because, once again, we don't know, because of the changed circumstances, exactly what the new stadium is going to look like.
But I thought we did know. Let's see if I'm the only one of that opinion. Let's talk to the former SDLP Special Advisor, Brendan Mulgrew. We'll talk to the GAA journalist, Declan Bogue, in a moment. Brendan, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
Am I right? Do we not already know what the GAA now wants?
Yes, Mark, I was surprised when I heard the Secretary of State's comments yesterday. Of course, all of the talk since Friday night has been that the Euro 28 project is now off the table. Casement will not be built to the European, to the UEFA specifications. But there is planning permission in place. It was granted in 2021, as you've just played the clip from Nicola Mallon. And that was before the Euros were on the agenda. There was probably talk around the Euros back then that it may have been a bid. But when planning permission was granted in 2021, hosting the Euros in Casement was not on the horizon. It certainly wasn't on the short-term agenda. And the planning permission was not granted with the Euros in mind. I listened to Hilary Benn last night, and I took from what he was saying that he was under the impression that the planning permission that's in place and the design that is in place is a Euro 28 compliant one. And therefore, if it's off the table, we need to go back to the drawing board. That's not the case, because we have planning permission and we've crossed all the planning hurdles. As you know, you were in court for the judicial review 10 years ago.
Yeah.
More than that, we passed all the legal hurdles. The challenges which remain are identifying the costs, and then number two, identifying where the money is coming from to get the stadium built. But what we don't need, and my goodness, if we go back to the drawing board and start talking about a new design altogether, that's a new planning process that would be subject to potential challenges. That would set the whole thing back a depressing number of years, Mark, to the kind of timescale where you think, is this ever going to be built? We do not need to go there.
Well, we have asked the NIO to clarify exactly what the Secretary of State meant by that. We haven't given them a lot of time. If we get an answer before the end of the programme, we'll bring it to you before 10:30. But Brendan, is it your view that that original design is what is still on the table? There's no chance of the GAA scaling back now.
I don't think that there is. In the immediate term, the plan is to build that stadium as a provincial stadium capable of hosting Ulster finals and other high-profile matches. There always was an argument, a very legitimate one, Mark, about what size of stadium do we need? Do we need a smaller one, the size that exists in Armagh or in Newry for those county teams? But that argument has been had, and the GA decided all of those years ago that what was required and what would be the best outcome for West Belfast and for Antrim and for Ulster would be a new provincial stadium. Ulster finals currently take place at Clonus. With all due respect to our friends down in Clonus and County Mahon,
careful.
It's had its day.
Careful.
Mark, it's a terrible venue to get to get into, to get out of. Going to Clonus gives you a headache. And, you know, if there was an Ulster final in Caseon Park with the motorway access and ample parking around about and provision made for park and
ample
ride.
Ample parking, Brendan? Really?
Provision for park and ride, Mark. I should have put the emphasis on that more than ample parking. You know, I think you would get neutral fans saying, I'm going to go to Ulster final, almost no matter who's playing. I think when the Ulster finals are on now in Clonus, the participating counties, loyal followers go to it, but not many others other than the teams involved. I think that the die has been cast with regards to the size of the stadium which the GA wants to build, and it's a 34,500-seater stadium. The planning is in place, the legal challenges have been overcome. What we need now is decisions, or very quick decisions, please, around how much they're going to cost, okay, and where's that money coming from.
Before I bring in Declan, what do you think was going on with the Secretary of State last night then? Did he get it wrong, or has he heard something we haven't?
Well, Jarlath Burns was very adamant on the Sunday Politics show on Sunday that the stadium that we're talking about is the one which we have planning permission for. I think that the Secretary of State, and you know, I would have, despite what happened on Friday night, and it was very, very disappointing, I still would have more faith in Hillary Benn than I would have any of his immediate predecessors from the Tory government. I'd like to think that he just got caught up in the Euro 28 context and made an assumption which I think was the wrong assumption.
Declan Bogue, what's your take on all of this?
Not to just, you know, not to pass off my responsibilities as a contributor, Brendan, very much behind on there. But I think he's slightly on his country cause down there in Clonus. I kind of think that having watched the broadcast last year for Hillary Benn, he might have been slightly, not saying he might have been confused, but there's so much that has gone on with this that he's not quite thinking back to that time when Nicol Mahon passed off the stadium, such as it was. They are going to look at this and say, if you're
Declan,
going to...
I'm sorry to interrupt, that's not a great line. Brendan, he was defending Clonus there. I mean, could they pump a bit of money into Clonus?
Well, I mean, I saw a column in the Irish News this morning suggesting that if the money's not coming to build Casement, that the money which exists should do up Clonus and build a smaller ground at Casement.
That was Cathair O'Kane's article in the Irish News, yeah.
Yeah, I read that this morning. The problem is, you know, and I've been to Clonus many times, it's not the stadium that needs a lick of paint. It's the road and it's the infrastructure into and out of Clonus. It just doesn't suit hosting tens of thousands of people. I mean, if you go to a match in Clonus, you're writing off your entire day, getting there and getting back. It's a brilliant atmosphere, Creighton's Hotel, meeting up, the crack, it's fantastic. But it's just too burdensome for getting into and out of. It's not a modern day...
Oh, Brendan, you're sounding like a city boy here. You're sounding like a city boy. And, well, and anyone who's been on the West Link this morning will tell you that's not too easy. And we have somebody here. We could talk about this all day, actually. We are going to talk about this later in the week. A lot of people complaining about a lot of traffic around the Grosvenor Road and the West Link since the new Grand Central Station started. We will return to that. But the point is, Casement, if it is ever built, isn't going to be that accessible, is it?
But another point, Mark, I think that there's a parking plan in place. All of that was considered by the planners and everyone on the road service and all the statutory consultees had their say in the normal way that a planning application is dealt with and therefore and approved. So the plans are in place for major events to take place in Gibson Park. And, you know, if you drive up and down or drive past the Anderstown Road, you know, I've been there and you've been there. It's now 11 years since there was a game played in Casement, and Justin McNulty made the point yesterday on another show that, you know, a generation, we're in danger now of a whole generation of young boys and girls and footballers and hurlers and camogues and ladies footballers missing out on the opportunity to play in Casement Park. 11 years is far too long. And I just hope, Mark, that with the decision that came on Friday, okay, it means that the Euros aren't happening. I hope that a sort of culture doesn't set in where everyone sits back and goes, oh, the pressure's off now, but don't have to get it built by 2027 to have test events for 2028. Now is not the time to sit back and stop talking about the Casement. Now is the time for everyone to step up and start getting it bottomed out. That, too many politicians, Mark, say Casement will be built. Henry Benn said it on the 6th of July. A lot of ministers, including our First Minister, have said it a few times over the last few days. Without a plan, that's a slogan. Casement will be built is a slogan. It's not a plan. It's not a strategy. You know, it was disappointing yesterday to hear that our first and deputy first ministers met the Chancellor last Thursday and Casement wasn't on the agenda. It wasn't even discussed. I thought that would have been a nice opportunity or a welcome opportunity to press the case for an early and positive decision.
Well,
or
it's a different department, in fairness. It's the Department for Culture, Media and Sport that has the money for that. And listen, we've got Declan Bogue back. I just want to give Declan a chance to defend our County Monaghan friends in Clonus. Declan.
Yeah, Mark, sorry about that. No, look, everything that Brendan said is entirely reasonable and makes perfect sense. If you were looking at the size of the stadium, say, you know, 34,500, do we need any smaller? Well, you know, the flagship event that you're going to host is the Ulster Final, and it will get, and especially in the first decade or so when there's a new stadium bounce and there's the way it goes in Ulster anyway is that these final places are shared out around more so than other provinces. So, like, you'll be talking about the first decade of packed out houses at Ulster Finals. Then there'll also be a number of, like, All-Ireland quarterfinals, whatever. Yeah. Whatever way they land on whatever competition structure, there will be high profile games there which will attract. So the scale of it has to be that. Otherwise, there's no point building it. There's no point building a 20,000 stadium to mirror what you have in Armagh already. You just have to go with it.
And is that the mood within the GAA as you understand it, Declan? It says 34,500 capacity stadium, not 34,500 seater. It's going to be 26,000 seats and then 8,500 standing. That's what Nicola Mallon gave planning permission to 3 years ago. And that's the only show in town, is it?
Well, I think it's the only sensible show. The all-seater thing was never, look, you know, I mean, you don't need a mini Croke Park in Belfast. I do believe that a wee bit of, some people do prefer standing anyway, you know, some dinosaurs like myself, but you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And then that also gets you out the gap with any kind of planning concerns and so on.
Okay. We're going to return to the money issue about all of this because money doesn't grow on trees. The former communications and strategic consultant at UEFA, Ian Mallon, is on the line. Ian, good morning to you.
Good morning.
From memory, you were ahead of the game on this one. You saw this happening, the Euros not working out at Casement.
Yeah, so originally, Mark, 2 years ago, I broke the story that Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England would get the Euros if they desisted from putting a bid in for to be UEFA's representative for the FIFA World Cup in 2030. They ceded to that and the way was paved for a five-nation sort of Euros in 2028. Now, at the time, talking to former colleagues in UEFA and other people around that, there was always an asterisk over Northern Ireland. You know, Northern Ireland would most certainly be part of this or was part of this, but only if Casement, and it was kind of that phrase, only if Casement can get done. Now, about a year ago, I kind of came to the conclusion Casement will not get done. There's absolutely no way in the world. And don't forget, we're all looking at 2028. It needs to be up and running by early 2027 so they can host test events. I've been involved in Euro 2020, which was supposed to be in the Aviva, but obviously fell off the roster because of COVID. And the level of examination and interrogation of these sites goes back many, many years. So when you're looking at a derelict site in Belfast, it just didn't seem realistic. Mm. And then, of course, the contractors pulled out late last year as well for various reasons, the two key contractors. And I was on your the breakfast show.
Yeah, Good Morning Ulster, I heard you, yes.
Yes, in July, around the same time, I think Hillary Bennett made comments that it would happen, or that he was hopeful that it would happen. And even then, I mean, you had the First Minister at the time as well saying it would happen, but she kind of rolled back slightly within her her term. And even the language then was, look, this is certainly not happening. I reported at the time, look, it's not going to happen. Yeah. And that was a real pity.
And it's definitely not going to happen. No. We've got this UEFA statement saying, you know, they're going to talk to the UK and Ireland to discuss the implications. But it was made very, very clear by Patrick Nelson, the chief executive of the Irish Football Association, last night. It's over. Ian, I have this idea. Call me naive. I'm a bit of a stadium geek. I've been to 54 of the 92 league grounds in England. I've watched cricket across Europe. I love a set of floodlights. What about...
I'm like you.
Are you? All right. Good on you.
Fancy.
We should go on a tour of German football stadiums at some stage. I had this idea. Okay, could you... Back to your asterisk. I love that expression. An asterisk beside Northern Ireland. We are a little bit different. We have a different history. We have Windsor Park sitting there with a capacity of 18,500. Way below what you need for a Euro game. About, what, 12, 13,000 at least short. But could you, under our special circumstances, go to UEFA and say, give us one game. Just give us one game.
Yeah, it's very interesting you bring that up. I was looking at that very issue this morning, and to me, there is absolutely no reason why Windsor Park cannot be used for a number of games. And this is how I think this would work. This could work. I'll tell you why it won't work in a minute, but how it could work. So say, for example, and no disrespect to either nation, I'm just using these as an example. Say we had a fixture with North Macedonia and Slovenia, let's say. Not the most attractive fixture, by the way, for Belfast either, but still, it means you're participating in this tournament and you're part of it. Similar sort of games that wouldn't be, say, England and Germany or Spain and Portugal sort of thing. That, yes, they could absolutely work out a number of games, not one, two, three, four, that could take place in Windsor Park. And remember, Windsor Park very successfully hosted the
Super Cup,
which I was at. A couple of years ago, which Chelsea played in, and that was a hugely successful occasion. Even on TV, watching it afterwards, Windsor Park doesn't look insignificant on television, by the way. I know it's only 18,500-seater, but it still looks like it is a very, very good stadium. Yes, UEFA could do that, but the big issue for UEFA, and this is when you look at revenue, particularly within the national organisation body for all 55 national associations, one of the key revenue drivers besides broadcast is ticket revenue, and for UEFA that won't stand. But still, it shouldn't be the overriding factor. Belfast should still be part of this. It should still be included, because UEFA is it's based in Switzerland. I've been there many, many times, and it's a little bit aloof and a little bit removed from the norm. And what I think, without being too dramatic on this. This is extremely, now you can see a lot of anger and a lot of discussion about Casement Park not being part of it and Belfast not being part of it. You just wait, Mark, till early 2028 when the anticipation across the other four nations is going to be unbelievable. And suddenly there'll be a bit of an inferiority complex around Northern Ireland. We should have this. And it's really, really terrible, because there's talk of, there might be friendly games there, or there's some club
team
and use the facilities.
I think there will be. Ian. What about another consolation prize? Give us the opening ceremony. We could host that, could we?
That's a very good idea, absolutely. But I think they're big ticket events as well, and they'll want to have that in Wembley. But, there is a duty of care for UEFA to look after the Irish Football Association, Patrick Nelson and his brilliant team up there. And to simply just say, no, you're not hosting. They can host games in Windsor Park, absolutely. There is a duty of care of the other four national associations to say, hold on a second, we came into this deal, and particularly the FA, by the way, which carry enormous influence in UEFA. To say, well, no, guys, we are a five nation army here. Yeah. We need to be part of the same thing, and it cannot in any way deviate. But don't forget, Mark, this is football, And football is very selfish and very self-interested sort of business, like a lot of the key sports. And once Dublin is happy, once London, Edinburgh and Cardiff are happy, it's very hard to think about somebody else in those circumstances, which is a real pity.
Well, even though Brendan Mulgrew is a Spurs fan, he knows a bit about football as well. Brendan, do you think we have any chance of getting one game?
I mean, the situations which would allow it exist because there are games between lesser teams, but I don't know enough about UEFA to see how that would work, Mark, and therefore I would be pessimistic about it. I also think, you know, we have an opportunity here ourselves to drive this project forward and to get the thing built in time to host it. It's almost like, why should we get a game if we turn down the opportunity to be a genuine host nation? Which has implications, by the way, for Northern Ireland if they don't qualify through the qualification system. And neither team in this island are exactly world beaters at the moment.
No, fair point. But if Ian is right that we're well got, that Patrick Nelson is well respected in Zurich, should we not fight for something now?
Yeah, we should be, because I think in 4 years' time, or three years, 8 months' time, or whatever, there's going to be recriminations all around the place when we see tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of Dublin and Glasgow and Cardiff and London, and we're sitting pointing the finger at each other going, why have we got a big screen up at the City Hall and that's our lot? And that may well be the case. So if there's a way that we can squeeze goodwill out of UEFA and host a sort of a game between two of the maybe lesser lights, let's go for that. But we've missed the big picture, Mark. My fear is that we've sort of accepted that Belfast doesn't belong in the top tier of cities now when it comes to hosting major events. That, to me, that's the sort of outcome of this couple of years long saga as to whether or not we would play our part in hosting the Euros. Why do we have to accept that we can't host those big sporting events when we've done it in the past? You know, it wasn't an issue for car parking with 40,000 people at concerts in Boucher Road. Yeah. We can't host these things. Yeah. But between us all, between the various bodies carrying responsibility for funding and decision-making, the opportunity has been let slip. I just think it's a real shame.
Brendan, I think you're in trouble. Brian is on the line from the West, from Enniskillen. Brian, do you want a word with Brendan?
Well, I'm afraid Brendan's talking in post terms again. And the dream in Brendan's head is over. I think he needs to get over it for a start. But tell me, the program slightly broke up. Which was it? Was it the stadium in Cavan that Brendan was claiming was, in his eyes, redundant, or where was it?
Clonus and Monaghan.
Right, Clonus and Monaghan. Okay. Well,
I'm sorry that Brendan would have to get off his backside and actually travel to outside of the global entity of that.
Faster beyond. But here's what I would suggest to Brendan.
The GAA's bluff was called in relation to Casement Park. It didn't put his hand deep enough in his pocket. The interview that Jared gave a few weeks ago, I thought, was too insular for other people to
even sympathise with the GAA to get the full money for the Euros. So what I would suggest is this. Clonus should be redeveloped as a super stadium. And in Belfast, the stadium should be made for the population with a plus sign that want to play Gaelic in, what do you call the area that it was again, sorry?
Andersonstown Road or Clonus?
No, Andersonstown Road.
Okay.
That should be developed.
Okay.
That should be developed for a medium-sized stadium for Gaelic, etc. And that's all that's needed there. I'll just also say to Brendan, from the point of view of parking and so forth, regardless of people parking on the hedge and the ditches at Clonus, it's a damn sight easier for Brendan to get, or the majority of Fermanagh and Tyrone and beyond, to get to Clonus than it is to try and get to the super-duper metropolis of Belfast. Before we talk about pollution in Belfast for a start and the particles whizzing about the air, etc. So, Brendan, move on. It's over. Okay, the GAA blew it. They were looking too much money off others instead of putting their hand deeper in their pocket. And that's the truth behind it.
Brendan, one quick line, then I want to go to Declan about where the money's going to come from.
Mark, I couldn't even bring myself to begin to answer those assertions. They don't stack up, so it's not worth a response.
Declan, where's the money going to come from to build this super-duper stadium in West Belfast, as Brian calls it?
Well, I suppose, you know, what's there before, what the price is going to take now from the design in 2021, I'd imagine all that has to be looked again and completely the price for building materials, the price for concrete, the price for steel is nothing like it was in 2021. So the quantity surveying, the project management, all this will have to be looked at again, and then you'll arrive at your figure. And it's whatever has been pledged so far, and then they look for the, look for the British government then to make up the shortfall.
And in terms of casement, Declan, just the final question, will it happen?
Oh, it will happen. There will be a new stadium, just maybe not what some people would have liked, but, you know, perhaps that is not a bad thing.
Ian Mallon, do you think it'll happen?
Well, casement has to happen, Mark. Well, I'm not sure when. I mean, as somebody pointed out there, now that Euros is not happening in 2028, there may be, and there has been an awful lot of political intransigence around this, that there may be a foot off the accelerator if it was ever even on it in the first place. Of course, it has to happen. How that happens, I cannot even. I just don't know, and the way things have gone, if it can't happen for a Euro 2028 or a European Championship football tournament, the second or third biggest football sporting event in the world, well, you know, an Ulster final in 2030, 2032, who knows?
You know? Brendan, do you think you'll see it?
I wouldn't want to indulge in the slogans when I criticise others for doing it, Mark. But ultimately, you know, at the minute we've got a big derelict hole in the middle of the Antrimstown Road where a GAA stadium used to be. This is a GAA city. I'd like to see it as a stronger GAA city, but it's the second city on the island. It's entirely appropriate and I think necessary and beneficial for all concerned that we do get a Casement Park built. And I think ultimately, I think we will get there.
And how much is it going to cost? Have you any idea?
I'd love to know where the 400 million figure came from on Friday night, and it would be very useful if those who use that figure were to put into the public domain where it came from. But if you strip out the UEFA specifications and the requirements that they had for a stadium, then perhaps we are looking at something which is much closer to the 250 million, which has been mentioned.
Yeah, 250 million, that's the figure knocking around. Brendan McGrew, thank you. Thanks also to Declan Bogue. Ian Mallon, I'll speak to you off air about a little tour of floodlights across Europe that you and I could do sometime. Thank you very much for everyone who has phoned in so far. Hang on the line. We'll have lots more calls after the news. It's coming up to 9:32. And in case you missed it, it's going to be 20 degrees in Belfast today, 21 degrees in Strabane and 21 degrees in Enniskillen. And we're in the second half of September. What is going on? We maybe need Jeff Maskell before the end of the programme. We might not get him, but we're going to have Gordon Lyons, the sports minister, after 10 o'clock. Hang on for that. We're going to be talking about the Hugh Edwards court case in a moment or two. But you've been phoning about casement. Let's go back to the lines. Let's go up to Coleraine. How warm is it there, Jason, before we get into casement?
Well, I think it's about 15 at the minute.
Oh, so, you're behind the times.
It's to get warmer later, but...
Will you go for a little swim?
No, I'll just go for a walk, so...
Go for a walk. So, do you think you'd be walking to casement any time soon, Jason?
No, definitely not. And my point is, now that we're not getting the years, there's no need for a 34,000-seater stadium. Obviously, they were guaranteed a stadium, and they will have a stadium built eventually. But the 34,000-seater stadium threshold was because of UEFA regulations. Now, as we sat all morning, we've heard about the Ulster final. They might be able to fill that one day a year for the Ulster final. But what is the average attendance at Antrim matches or here for the clubs means that? It's not what's no big year, 34,000. So build them a stadium, but not one that size.
Jason, they could hold All Ireland semi-finals or quarter-finals. I think all the semis aren't they at Croke Park. They could do qualifier matches. They could do Ulster semi-finals. As I mentioned in the introduction, they can do three outdoor concerts a year. Oh, it could wipe its own face, that stadium, eventually, could it not?
But the thing is, talking about the outdoor concerts and that, is that money going to be going to go, and that money going to the public, or is it all going into the GAA coffers? That's the thing.
Well, they have to manage the stadium.
So, but does the rest of the public not get anything out of it?
Well, they have spent $4 million clearing the site already. They put all the time and the money and the effort into it. That's how it works with stadiums across the world.
But the thing is, Stormont and the British government will be putting the most money on it. So $4 million will be nothing compared to what is going to be built.
Jason, they haven't put a penny in yet.
Well, they they more or less gave a guarantee years ago.
Yes.
So are they going to go back on it? I mean, I'm not a GAA supporter by any means.
Yeah.
So like, I was against Casement to start with. I don't think it should ever have been there.
Well, I need to be fair to the government. There is $62.5 million coming from the Stormont executive. That's ring fence. And you could argue that comes from London as well, because obviously they control the purse strings. Nothing more yet from the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn. Jason, I'll let you go and go for your little walk there in the 15 degrees and cold rain. Back here in balmy Belfast, Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert.
Mark, I don't believe that Casement Park should be built. It's a better alternative for the site of Casement Park would be to build social housing and private housing and a friendship centre and a play park, because the voices of the residents of Casement Park has been drowned out. Now, if you're going to build a stadium, build it on the North Foreshore, where you could build a stadium, a hotel, a theme park, or a golf course, which would bring a greater revenue in for a greater investment for the people of Northern Ireland.
Is that the road out to Carrick from Belfast you're talking
just
about?
Adjacent to the Fort William roundabout,
okay.
The North Foreshore.
Okay.
But now, I've said
I think
there
that was looked at before, Robert, actually, and was ruled out for some reason.
Yeah, but I think we're going to start to maybe re-look at it again, because I don't want Hilary Benn and Keir Starmer being deceived.
It's not natural GAA country, if I can put it like that.
No, but it's a neutral setting. It's a neutral setting.
But the GAA, are they not entitled to their own stadium where they have the bulk of their support?
Yes, but we can also... Yes, they are, but at the same time, building a stadium on the North Foreshore would bring a greater investment in. It could be a neutral setting, and it could be used for sports, GAA, football, pop concerts and things like that.
Okay, so, Robert. Thank you very right. much indeed. Let's go to the Andersonstown Road. Paul's back on the air. Hello again, Paul.
How you doing, Mark? Thanks for speaking to me again this morning. Poor Robert and the caller before, they're absolutely distraught with this Casement Park being built. I just wanted to speak about Hilary Benn's contribution to the latest contribution to the debate. I don't know what this guy's talking about. The people who are advising him are wrong, or He's being disingenuous. As you well know, and your contributors know this morning, planning permission was granted for Casement Park 3 years ago, and planning permission was granted for a scaled back version of what the GAA had already submitted for its plans. So what you have now is a 34,000 seater stadium. There is no other stadium. I mean, what Hilary Benn was saying last night was akin to me. To going back to the drawing board, basically to start from scratch. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. I think we're beyond that time now. The plans are already in. They've been in for 3 years.
Yeah.
That's the stadium that the GAA envisages being built on the Andersonstown Road.
And Paul, remind me, do you believe it will happen?
Oh, it'll happen, absolutely. I have no doubt in my mind that Casement Park will be built.
Well, remember where we heard it first, Paul. Get you out into the sunshine. Alex... from Lisburn. What's it like in Lisburn, Alex?
Oh, something is awesome in Lisburn. I've just been following the story. But I come back. I was going back there as the point I made a couple of mornings ago. The GAA's contribution. Whenever they made, I think it's $15 million. Whenever they made that, it would have been a certain proportion of the expected cost. Well, the expected cost has gone through the roof. To no fault of the GAA's. But yeah, surely they should be obliged to meet that same proportion of the cost.
Yeah, I've heard this argument. That amounted to around 20% at the time. So if you're saying that if it's $250 million, they have to do my mental maths, pay $50 million. Is that what you're saying, Alex?
Correct. Okay. Now, I remember when they were building Croke Park. I think Bertie Ahern was the Taoiseach, and he had a falling out with the GAA. Over there, and he was more or less saying, if I remember correctly, that they were being arrogant. And there's the same level of arrogance coming through again.
Well,
and particularly when the other morning when they were claiming that the money from Dublin was their money.
Well, they negotiated it.
Oh, well, they negotiated. They weren't writing the cheque.
Okay.
They weren't writing the cheque. You know, if it was 20% of the cost originally, they should still have to meet 20% of the cost. I also hear on the radio people talk about, with all this public money going into it, for Gaels, the term Gaels used. Gaels is a very divisive term.
Is it?
I'm not a Gael. I wouldn't count. It certainly wouldn't be. I wouldn't count myself as a Gael.
Well, yeah, that was Nicola Mallon saying it. But you know what she meant.
I know. What I thought she meant was people who play GAA.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to put public money into something that's going to be used for pop concerts and this sort of thing,
yeah.
Well, it should be a more inclusive language should be used in talking about who's going to use the thing and who's going to be built for.
Okay, Alex. You've made your point, and we'll let you go.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And you, good morning.
That's a free democracy for you. Bye.
Bye-bye, Alex. Now, before we move on to our next story, I just want to warn you, you may find some of the detail disturbing. We're going to talk about Hugh Edwards. He avoided jail yesterday. He admitted accessing indecent images of children as young as 7, but he wasn't sent to prison. The 63-year-old now was given a suspended sentence. It means he'll go to prison for 6 months, but only if he reoffends within the next 2 years. The BBC said it was appalled by Edwards' crimes and that he had betrayed not just the BBC, but the audiences. But some are questioning if that sentence was too lenient. I've been speaking to the legal analyst Joshua Rosenberg, and he explained exactly what were the sentencing guidelines that the judge had to deal with yesterday.
The maximum is 10 years, but obviously not everybody gets the maximum. What the magistrate senior district judge took into account was, first of all, aggravating factors, for example, the age of the child. In one case, the child involved was aged around 7 to 9. That was a significant aggravating feature, which made things worse. But there were mitigating features, no previous convictions, Hugh Edwards' remorse, his positive character in the past, and mental disorder, showing that his decision-making could have been adversely impaired by a mixture of mood disorder, neurocognitive disorder and alcohol consumption. The magistrate accepted that Edwards would be particularly vulnerable in a custodial setting. In other words, somebody might have a go at him in prison, although the magistrate said that alone would not have prevented an immediate custodial sentence.
Given that criteria, was it still possible that the judge could have decided to send Edwards to jail?
Certainly possible, because the starting point, after deciding that, as the magistrate put it, the custody threshold had been crossed, the starting point would have been 12 months because of the most serious images. Shorter sentences for the other images to run concurrently. But taking into account those mitigating factors I mentioned, that was reduced to 9 months. And you get a third off if you plead guilty at the earliest possible opportunity. So that takes it down to 6 months. And the question then is whether the sentence can be suspended. You know that magistrates and courts generally are under, not exactly pressure, but they're told under guidelines that they should suspend a sentence rather than have an immediate custodial sentence where possible. And what Edwards was told was that he didn't present a risk or danger to the public at large, or specifically to children, that the focus of sentencing should be on rehabilitation, that immediate custody was not essential if there was a realistic prospect of rehabilitation, and the magistrate accepted his neurovulnerabilities and his remorse, and he said that the combination of Edwards being forced to confront his wrongdoing in a very public way, his request for professional help, and what the court called the supportive blanket, which that and the input of probation would provide, meant that if he had a suspended prison sentence with requirements to report to probation officers and so on, that would rehabilitate him and strike the balance between public protection and rehabilitation.
You've just half answered my next question. Remind us exactly what a suspended sentence is. And if we take the case of Hugh Edwards, what will it mean for him?
It means that for the next 2 years, if he commits any offence, he'll be brought back to court. Obviously, he might be punished for any new offence he might commit. But the original sentence of 6 months could be brought into operation. So it's held over him for 2 years. And during that time, he has to not commit any criminal offences, otherwise it may be brought into effect. And that certainly happens in cases, in many cases. He has to report to his supervisor, probation officer, when he's told to. He must cooperate with any instructions he's given. We know that he's getting various treatment and so on. And if he fails to comply with any of these requirements, then he could be sent to prison.
And in terms of how that is policed as such, it's not as if the authorities will be checking his phone every week. It's only if something comes to light unilaterally.
I think that's right. Certainly, there are requirements in some cases for tagging. You have to wear an electronic tag. It shows where you are. Tags can also detect whether you've been misusing alcohol. You might have to report to a police station. That sort of thing happens in other cases. I'm not saying it happened in this case. But there are certainly examples of how requirements to report to probation officers are enforced to ensure that people are staying well, staying on the straight and narrow, and not at risk of committing further offences.
And Joshua, you will have seen some of the commentary since yesterday that suggests that perhaps Edwards got preferential treatment because he was a high-profile figure. When you've read that, what have your thoughts been?
You can understand the thinking behind it, but I think this decision is in line with the guidelines more generally. Certainly, it was said that because he is instantly recognisable, he would be at greater risk in prison than other people. We also know that prisoners take, and everybody else indeed, but prisoners in particular do not like people who are convicted of offences of this sort. And there are the problems of his mental health. He was a suicide risk, we're told, and those are other factors. I don't think that it's fair to say that this decision to suspend his sentence was out of line. As I say, this was a first offence, and the magistrate said in terms that if it hadn't been for the other factors, he might well have gone to prison immediately, but it wasn't his public fame that kept him out of prison. You can compare this sort of offence with punishment in prison for various protesters who cause a vast amount of disruption and so on, but that was not a fair comparison because the guidelines are different and the courts are under pressure. Even now, even though some people, quite a lot of people were released from prison last week, the courts are under pressure to keep the prison population down and not send people to prison unless it's absolutely necessary.
And final question, Joshua Rosenberg, is there any circumstance in which this sentence could be reviewed and changed at some stage?
No, there is a process whereby unduly lenient sentences are referred to the Court of Appeal and increased. But I'm pretty sure it doesn't apply to this particular decision in a magistrate's court. So, no, this is a sentence. The only circumstance in which he will go to prison would be if he breaches the terms of the suspended sentence by effectively committing other offences.
Crystal clear, as always. We appreciate it, Joshua.
Okay. Thanks very much indeed. All the best.
Thank you. So what do you think? Now we know the guidelines, the facts of the case. Do you think the sentence was too lenient? Let's ask two people who have followed the case, Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online and Danny Shaw, a former BBC colleague and also a former government advisor at the Home Office. I'll come to you in a moment, Danny. Good morning to you. Brendan O'Neill, what are your thoughts?
I think it is probably quite lenient. I take everything that Joshua just said there, which makes sense to me, but it does seem to a lot of people that we do have a two-tier justice system at the moment. And when you consider the fact that Hugh Edwards was given a suspended prison sentence, so he won't spend a minute in jail if he doesn't commit any offences in the next 2 years, but then a 53-year-old woman during the recent riots was sentenced to 15 months instantly incarcerated for writing a horrible thing on social media. So, and there were other people who were in prison during the riots for putting things on social media. So it does look to a lot of people out there that if you are a member of the white working classes, if you are so-called riffraff, and you put horrible words online, you will be banged up for more than a year. If you're a well-connected journalist who used to be the big dog at the BBC, and you buy and possess images of a seven-year-old child involved in sexual behavior, you will get a suspended sentence. That doesn't seem fair, I would say, to a lot of people out there.
Danny Shaw?
Well, I think that's nonsense. You know, the offence that Hugh Edwards committed is committed, sadly, by thousands of people across the country. And the standard sentence, as Joshua Rosenberg has explained, for someone who doesn't have a criminal record, who's admitted their guilt, is a suspended sentence. It applies to people who are working class, middle class, professional, whatever occupation they have. There were no special favours here for Hugh Edwards because of his job. It was all about the fact that it was a first-time offence. He'd admitted his guilt, expressed remorse, and there were some background mental health issues. Prison is a last resort for offending of this type. I mean, we can have a discussion about whether this is a suitable deterrent or whether he should have had a harsher penalty, but to kind of read across that this is something, this is some class based on his class and his job, is just frankly rubbish. In terms of comparing it with sentences from the riots, I think it's very dangerous to compare one sort of category of offending with another, one instant, one, you know, with another. The riots were a specific moment in time where people had to be brought, people had to be arrested, charged, and brought before the courts within days, you know, within hours in some cases, because we had riots sweeping the country. And a deterrent message had to go out, firstly, and secondly, the perpetrators had to be removed from the streets. And that's what happened. And it was right that that happened.
Brendan?
Well, that's complete nonsense. The idea that class doesn't impact on the justice system in the United Kingdom.
That's not what I said, Brendan. You made a specific case.
Having an understanding of the history and the sociology of Britain. But the point is,
Brendan. I was talking about your specific allegation that this offence was dealt with more leniently because
from a working class background is speaking, nonsense. If you don't mind. The point is, he's right to say that you can't compare these two kinds of offences, because Hugh Edwards' offence was far more grave than someone like Julie Sweeney, for example. Julie Sweeney is a 53-year-old woman who was not involved in the riots, but she went on Facebook during the riots and wrote something that was really horrible and really repulsive. She had never bothered the law before. She was recognised to be of good character. She was the sole carer for her disabled husband, and she was put in jail for 15 months. Now, whose offence is more serious in that situation? The 53-year-old woman who put one sentence online that was a horrible sentence, or the man who bought and possessed images of seven-year-old children being sexually assaulted? So it is entirely legitimate and entirely just for ordinary people out there to say, look, we understand the sentencing guidelines, we understand that the law and judges have to behave in a certain way, but socially, in terms of the message that this sends to the different sections of society, it is a concerning message. It's not rubbish and nonsense for people to ask these questions about the justice system that we all live under.
Danny?
You can ask questions about the justice system. I'm not saying that's rubbish or nonsense, but I'm saying your assertion Hugh Edwards was given a more lenient sentence because he's a professional is just not supported by the evidence at all in terms of this particular case. Of course, we can have a discussion about whether, the sentence handed out to that particular woman was harsh compared to other sentences. You can read across all different categories of offending and make those arguments. We can talk about the Just Stop Oil protesters, whether their sentences were too harsh. You know, some of them have gone to prison for several years compared to other people who get suspended sentences. That's absolutely fine. The most important thing is that, you know, is the sentence, does it accurately reflect the crime? Is it going to deter other people from doing it? Will it stop this particular individual from doing it again? Is prison absolutely necessary? Those are some of the things you have to ask yourself. And actually, punishment is not going to be the way out of this problem with people who use images of children, child sexual abuse images for their gratification, that's not going to be the way out of this problem.
Punishment.
You cannot arrest yourself out of this problem. It's about social media companies.
What do you mean punishment is not the way out for people who possess the most grotesque images imaginable?
You're not going to be able to arrest
yourself. You say they shouldn't be punished.
Out of this. No, I didn't say that. You cannot arrest. Of course they need to be punished. Of course they need to be punished. They absolutely need to be punished severely punished, particularly.
Would you say punishment is not the way out for people who engage in riotous behaviour?
No.
So what's the difference between? No, but what is the difference? Why are you saying that punishment is not the solution to people who share grotesque
punishment again,
children
Brendan,
raped?
You're mangling my words, which is what you've done. Behavior.
Danny, just clarify
Brendan,
exactly
you're
what you meant.
My words.
Clarify what you meant.
Yes. We cannot arrest ourselves out of the problem of men viewing child sexual abuse images for their gratification, because you will never be able to arrest everyone who's doing it. It's about stopping it in the first place, getting the social media companies to clamp down on the sort of images that are on their platforms. That's one particular way of doing it. The second thing about is preventing it from happening in the first place, and educating people and ensuring that, you know, if they're going down that path, that they stop it, as well as when they're caught, dealing with people in an appropriate fashion. That's what I meant. So please don't mangle my words, Brendan.
Let's take a time out here. We'll go to the lines very quickly. Jane is on the line from Temple Patrick. Jane, a quick point if you can.
Good morning. An absolute disgrace that he got off so lightly. Of course he's very sorry. We're all sorry. And you would get more for tossing a cigarette butt out of a car.
Oh, you wouldn't. You wouldn't, Jane.
Oh, you would. I know somebody who was done. She was a nurse. She was coming from her work. And she tossed a cigarette butt out of her car. They got her number and she was fined £60.
Yeah, well, she didn't get a suspended prison sentence. So you think it was too lenient. Why do you think it was too lenient, Jane?
It's only encouraging other perverts to behave like this. It's a money talks. The only thing it ever said to me was cheerio. Do you mean to tell me that there wasn't somebody leaning on somebody somewhere to get such a lenience? 6 months, it's ridiculous. And then I didn't see it, but I haven't saw the headlines yet. Her child was abused sexually. And he's added a life sentence. That's not just a 10-minute half hour. He'll be out again. Swanning around.
No, Jane, you need to be careful here. We don't know that. Jane, I just want to go back to Brendan very quickly to give him the last word on this. Brendan, is there any evidence that the highlighting of cases like this does act as a deterrent?
Well, I'm not sure that there is, but I just do think that if people are in possession of images like this, call me old-fashioned, that they need to be punished. And I think there is a legitimate role for the justice system, not only to rehabilitate people, which I do think is important, but also to punish people, to say, well, we are going to deprive you of your liberty, which is the highest punishment we can inflict, because you've done something that is incredibly damaging to children. And I think that's probably the best message for society to send when something like this happens.
Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online, Danny Shaw, former government advisor at the Home Office. Thank you very much indeed. If you've been disturbed by anything that you've heard on the radio, we do have the BBC Action Line website available for you. We're going to talk more after 10 o'clock about two other things. We're going to talk about the weather. It's a very sunny day out there. And we're also going to talk about more about Casement, because we're going to be live on air, joined by the Sports Minister, Gordon Lyons. Back now to our top story. How big a stadium should now be built at Casement Park? Do they still need room for more than 34,000 fans? The Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, says he now needs to know exactly what the GAA wants.
Clearly, there needs to be a new design, because it'll be a very different kind of stadium for that was envisaged for the Euros.
And that's why he's avoiding questions about the money.
Now is not the time to pledge a sum, because once again we don't know, because of the changed circumstances, exactly what the new stadium is going to look like.
Let's talk to the Sports Minister, Gordon Lyons. Good morning. Good morning, Gordon Lyons.
Good morning.
Do you know what the GAA now wants?
No. I think we have to recognise the ultimately the design of Casement Park is a matter for primarily for the GAA. There are different options that are available. Obviously, the current design that was in place for the Euros was scaled up in order to accommodate everything additional that UEFA would require. It may now be the case that they want to continue with that design, albeit scaled back, or they may want the new design altogether. But ultimately, it is for them to bring forward the plan that they want to see how this would progress.
Would you have any idea how much it's going to cost?
No, look, it's very, very difficult for us to make any estimates on these before we know exactly what it is that they want. We know that it was very, very expensive to convert what would have been a GAA stadium into a Euros-enabled and UEFA-compliant stadium in time for the Euros, and that's where so much of the additional cost had come from. And we saw these costs just rise and rise and rise, and that was because of the additional requirements and the constrained time frame and all of the additional pressures that would have been on that project that increased the cost. We're now dealing with something very, very different, with it not being done for the Euros. That now being off the table, the Secretary of State is right to say that a different plan will be looked at. Whether that is an entirely new design or not is a matter for the GAA. You'll be aware of the Northern Ireland Football Fund that I've been progressing this year, and I've been going out and meeting various clubs, both at performance and grassroots level, and they have amended some of their plans because the money that is available for that is worth less than it was when it was originally announced, and some people have had to put together more modest plans than would otherwise have been the case. But in all circumstances, we're looking at what the need is, and we are trying to make sure that that need is met for sport in Northern Ireland. And this has obviously been a significant controversy for some time now in regards to Casement, and the GAA might want to take some time to consider what they need and how they can achieve that. And they will obviously need to come up with something that is affordable and value for money.
Have you reached out to them? Have you invited them to a meeting?
Well, I've said now for some time that I'd be more than happy to meet with them. Obviously, this is still very fresh. The announcement only came on Friday. But as I said on my statement, I'm more than happy to engage with them to see how the department can be of assistance.
I thought their plan was their 2021 plan, the 34,500 GAA-only stadium.
So there's a number of different plans that have come about. I think the original plan was for the 2021 statement to be built and then to retrofit it in time for the Euros with the requirements that that would have necessitated. There was then a different plan to build what originally would have been a UEFA stadium, and then it would have been scaled back. So look, I'm not exactly sure what their plans are, where they are taking this next. They'll want to take stock with other partners, but ultimately it will be for them to come forward with their plans and for them to make an assessment of what's affordable and what's value for money.
I know some within the GAA, not everyone, is very critical of you, Gordon Lyons. They say you sat on your hands, you didn't put the stadium construction contract out to tender, and you're partly to blame for the fact that the Euros aren't coming here.
Well, I think it's actually been demonstrated that it was the right thing to do. Because if I was to have issued tender documents, we would now be in the position of having gone out and said to companies and businesses, not just in Northern Ireland, but across the UK and beyond, we want to build this stadium in Northern Ireland, but we don't have the money for it. So I think that that would have been a very poor tendering process to start off with. But there's been a lot of talk lately about reputational damage to Northern Ireland. I think it would have caused reputational damage to my department and to the wider executive. If we ask companies to spend upwards of hundreds of thousands of pounds putting together a bid, and for me not to have the funding secured for that, and then just to go and say to them, by the way, I've gone out to tender, but I don't have the money secured for that.
But rightly or wrongly, they saw you as someone who wasn't very friendly towards the GAA in your first 6 months in office. You didn't even go to a game.
Well, I actually was invited to two games, and diary commitments meant that that didn't allow me to attend, and I've explained the reasons for those. I was invited to one GAA club, and I took up that invite. I'd met with Jareth Burns. I've met with other officials from the GAA during my time in office, but ultimately, the decision that some seem to take issue with is the fact that I didn't issue tender documents, but that decision has been entirely vindicated, and it would have come at a cost. And the process itself was very complicated. Without getting into the details of it, it would have been a two-stage tender process. And before we would have got a final cost, it could have ended up costing millions of pounds to decide whether or not the project could have gone forward. Okay. Because it's only when you start some of the work, Mark, that you actually would have been in the position to have given a final cost. And none of this is straightforward, but if we want to look at the blame for this over the last 13 years, it's very unfair to look around for somebody else to blame whenever this has been the subject of judicial reviews, planning objections, issues with safety certificates and the actions of previous ministers. So I know that there's a desire out there to try and say that this was being deliberately held up.
Yes.
But ultimately, if people are looking to understand why Casement Park hasn't been built whenever Ravenhill and Windsor Park have been, I think they need to look back at the issues around planning in particular, the objections of local residents and the actions of previous ministers.
Let's look forward. I know you don't have much time left, but what are you going to do to make sure we get some slice of the pie at Euro 2028?
Look, I think it's absolutely right that we do try and get a legacy from the Euros. Look, there would be nothing better than being able to host matches here in Northern Ireland. I get that. That's what I wanted to see happen. And I know that that is now very unlikely, but there are other options available to us. Let's see how we can play the role. What can we do in terms of training camps, in terms of warm-up games, and I don't think that work has been fully done or fully explored, because all of the focus, all of the energy over this period of time has been on Casement. And even though that was taking place in a very constrained budgetary environment with very, very tight deadlines, that seemed to be the only show in town. And I think there should have been some preparatory work that was done in terms of other ways in which we could host this tournament. Mm. Now, obviously, a lot of this is the responsibility of the IFA and the Department for the Economy, who would be responsible for hosting. But I'm saying I'm very keen to play whatever role I can as sports minister to encourage us to get to the point where we can work together to get a legacy, whether it's training camps, whether it's warm-up games, talking with UEFA, whatever else it might be.
Did you see my idea on social media about going to UEFA and saying, we're a little bit different here, just give us one match at Windsor Park. We know it's too small, but just give us one match.
Well, yeah, look, I understand that UEFA have their requirements. That's why Casement Park was looked at as an option. They have a requirement of 30,000 seats, and that's what was needed in order for us to host potentially four or five games. We're not going to be able to do that now, but yes, absolutely. I have advocated for us to go and to say, look, even for one game, to make this a proper Five Nations bid, is there a possibility that we can have some sort of a derogation to allow that to happen? Look, and I know that's a long shot. I know that's going to be very, very difficult, but I believe if there is the political will there and the will from the IFA, I think that it is something that we should at least try, and I want to do everything that we can to make sure that we get a real legacy from the Euros. Yes, the economic benefit and the social benefit as well, but I want to see more people involved in sport. I want to inspire young people. That's why I'm going to be hosting a celebration event for our Olympians in October. I want to do everything I can to promote sport in Northern Ireland, and I think that playing whatever role that we can in the Euros will enable us to do that, and I'll not be found wanting in trying to bring people together and see what we can do even at this late stage.
Speaking of promoting sport, did I see on social media swimming in the sea off East Antrim during the summer there?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. Not sure if any of that was on social media.
Yeah, I saw Sammy Wilson put something out. I think you were all clothed at the time. you had used a wetsuit, or had you gone in your trunks?
You can't use a wetsuit, Mark. That's cheating. Come on, you know that. No, yes, absolutely. I want more people to get involved, get more active more often. That includes the the minister, and you'll often see me off Ballygally going for a swim there. So I'll tell you what, Mark, I know you're interested in doing that as well. Why don't you come to East Antrim? This is going to be a nice week.
Oh, right.
So if you have the if you have the time, if you're up for it,
what have I done here?
Why don't you come and I'll take you for a little bit of a look around that part of East Antrim. I'm very happy to have you. That's not an invite I've extended to Stephen Nolan, but you're very, very privileged. So if you're up for that,
okay,
I'll happily do that this week.
Well, you've thrown me under a bus. I can't say no live on air. My people speak to your people.
That'll do.
And I'll see you in East Antrim before the end of this very sunny week. Gordon Lyons, the sports minister, thank you very much indeed. And there it is, folks. He is lobbying UEFA for a one-off derogation to allow Windsor Park, even though it's only about half the size of a stadium that they require for Euro 2028. He's going to ask UEFA if they would make a special exception and we could still have one game. We'll move on now. The time is 10:15 this Tuesday morning. You may have seen this on the news last night. The Ending Violence Against Women and Girls strategy has been launched at Stormont. It's taken a while. And as we know, the problems, the difficulties, the violence, there's no let up. In fact, they may even be coming more frequent. It seems every day we turn on the news and we hear of another attack. If you look at the official statistics, the only ones that we have are for 2023. And there were more than 33,000 domestic abuse incidents here in Northern Ireland, 33,000. Let's talk to the Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent, Alison Morris, and the Alliance MLA, Connie Egan. Alison, morning to you.
Good morning.
It's so depressing, this. It is hard to listen to. What difference will this strategy make, though?
It's interesting you use the word depressing because I was in listening to Court 10 in Belfast Magistrate yesterday, where a young man was charged with the murder of his own mother. And while I was waiting on that case, there was case after case after case involving allegations of domestic violence and abuse, from non-fatal strangulation to allegations of rape to people being attacked with bottles and hammers, and it just went on and on and on. And the magistrate actually said that it was a very depressing court list on the same day that the Stormont executive was launching their strategy for ending violence against women and girls. And it struck me how unusual that was. A district judge, Stephen Keown, it's very unusual to hear judges mention politics or anything from the bench during a sitting, a very big as he's sitting over court. But it was stark how many of those cases yesterday involved domestic abuse and allegations of domestic violence against women. The strategy is important and has been called for, and we're obviously the last place and last part of the UK to have an official government strategy for ending violence against women and girls. There's been a lot of work done on this ahead of time. There's been consultations and a lot of discussions with professionals. I suppose one of the two things that jumped out at me when I had a read through it is, one is the prevention, because it's always better that these things don't happen at all rather than how that you deal with them when they do. And that is about that education piece and teaching young men and women, especially what healthy relationships look like and boundaries and red flags and all of those things, so they can protect themselves. We take it for granted that people get that at home, but not everyone has a role model or a home where there is a healthy relationship. They actually might have been subjected or witnessed violence themselves growing up. That restricting and speaking about that easy access to very violent online pornography from a very young age, which has really, I think, twisted a lot of young men's minds. And then we also need to speak about that sort of Andrew Tate-style culture, that really misogynist culture that has permeated through the internet and is affecting, I suppose, the thoughts and how young men view women. And I hear that daily. And then there's obviously after, when something awful happens, how the justice system deals with it. And there has been a lot of changes and a lot of benefits with new legislation now in terms of non-fatal strangulation and coercive control. Judges can add domestic abuse as an aggravating factor when they're sentencing. But it also, there's a lot still to be done. I mean, one of the things when I'm contacted by women, which happens on an almost weekly basis, to say, you know, can you help me? I'm going through this. Is there anything I can do? It's the length of time often that it takes for these cases to come to court. Someone, remember, then they're thinking that they're going to have to face their abuser in a courtroom, and that hangs over them sometimes for a year and a half, 2 years. And then also, I suppose, the repeated breaking of restraining orders and non-molestation orders and bail conditions, and people continually being released again on bail and being released despite the fact that they are repeat offenders. And also what I have noticed, and this is something that I didn't particularly see reflected in the strategy, is that I see the same perpetrators of these type of crimes on the court list and in the courts day and daily. And the only thing that changes, the charges are the same, the name's the same. The only thing that changes is the name of the victim beside them, because there are repeat offenders who just jump from one very vulnerable woman to
Good
another.
Grief.
And they are the people I think that there should be a real clampdown on, so that they're not allowed or permitted to complete to go through a cycle of just destroying women's lives. And some of the women you can see, as you see them over the years, repeatedly appear in court, the victims become more and more vulnerable. They're often women from the care system, or people who've had their children removed, and it's just, you can see that they're so susceptible, and you just think the next time I'm in court, it's going to be for a murder, it's not going to be for an assault.
So this new strategy, Connie Egan, is in place. You probably had a chance to read through it. What do you make of it?
Yes, Mark, this strategy has been long overdue. We, for too long, Northern Ireland was the only part of the UK and Ireland which didn't have a strategy to end gender-based violence. I think for me, one of the most stark figures at the beginning of this strategy is that a report from Ulster University says 98% of women have experienced at least one form of gender-based violence or abuse in their lifetime. This is an absolutely huge issue, and I think it's really important that we have a strategy that recognises it will take a whole society approach to change this.
Can I ask you both, starting with you, Connie, sadly there will be people listening going through this. What hope can you give them when there probably seems no way out of whatever they're being subjected to? Connie?
I think it's a positive step forward that we have every party in the executive and in the assembly signed up to this strategy, to recognise that this is a huge pressing issue in our society, that there is a budget that is going towards not just provision in the justice system, but also prevention, because I think that's the most important thing, that we prevent this. And we understand that things such as misogynistic jokes or street harassment actually feeds into a society where rape, murder and violence against women is far, far too common. It can be a very dark place for women who are victims of gender-based violence, but we have fantastic agencies in Northern Ireland, such as Women's Aid, who provide frontline services for those women. And I think it's really important that we fully fund those and we recognise the good work we're doing. And I'm glad to see that as part of the strategy, there is a specific fund that will be going towards supporting organisations which help victims and survivors.
Alison?
Well, I mean, I do get contacted by women a lot, and what I would say is you have to get out, how difficult it is. And I know in a lot of cases it means moving children from their schools and all sorts of other things, and that is not easy, especially when women have been isolated by their abuser from all other family and friends and support. But, you know, that person isn't going to change. You're not going to be able to change them. You know, we're not the repair shop of broken men. We just can't fix them. And you are going to end up, you know, I don't want to be reporting on someone as a statistic if you know that this is happening and you keep thinking, well, maybe it'll get better and maybe it doesn't. It just escalates and gets worse. And there is help out there, and contact Women's Aid and seek out all the help that you can get, as difficult as that might be. And, you know, and what I would say is when someone shows you who they are the first time, believe them. You know, and that's it. If you see that kind of violent red flag in a partner, it's not going to get any better. It's only going to get worse. And please seek help and think of yourself and your own safety and your children's safety ahead of anything else.
Alison, do we all need maybe a bit of a shake in the media as well? I mean, it's almost become like the Troubles. I hate to say that. You know, you turn on the radio and you hear of another attack. I mean, was it 23 women or something have been murdered in Northern Ireland since 2020? And sadly, sometimes we lose a bit of the shock factor that we should have.
We do, and also I think that this is one of the things, and along with your colleague Tara Mills, I worked with Women's Aid a while ago trying to come up with some sort of set of guidelines about reporting these terrible incidents. What I have noticed too is we seem to the hierarchy of victims.
Yeah.
You know, if someone looks like they, you know, are someone who, you know, is from a well-off family, you know, has a degree, has a good job, mm-hmm. and they're murdered in this sort of way, you know, when we seen the awful death of Aisling Murphy in the South, our MLAs were standing having vigils on the steps of Stormont, but when Jennifer Dornan, a young single mother, was murdered in her own home and set fire, there was no such vigils. I went and covered her funeral. I don't think a single politician showed up to it. The fact is we can't have a hierarchy of victims of who doesn't deserve to be abused and who does, for a start. And also, I think the language we use, one of the things that I have noticed now, it is getting better, but you still see those headlines, you know, the man snaps after finding out that, you know, his wife did X, Y, and Z. Yeah. And so the defence and the excuse is put in the headline before the actual fact that a woman has been murdered. So, and also we also need to recognise that some of the men who we know and might be friends with and might be lovely in their work setting and outside can be very different at home, you know, and that's it. It's that, you know, angel in the streets or the devil in the home, you know, these. And we have seen in the past people have reported as being pillars of the community after they've beaten their wife to death. And I think that we need to be very careful about our language and how we use that and how we frame it as well.
Final word to you, Connie Egan. Do you think the media, and I'm talking about myself here as well as all of my colleagues, need to do something different too?
Again, this is a whole society approach. I think what Alison said is correct. Sometimes I see headlines and I find them galling. They really take away the fact that a woman has been abused or murdered. And I think a whole society approach is needed. How we think about domestic abuse and violence, the kind of idea that we have of a victim, this can happen to absolutely anybody. And I think that's what the statistics show, is how common this is in our society.
Yeah.
And while it's absolutely tragic that 23 women since 2020 have lost their lives, if we look in further at the amount of violence, abuse, harassment, and those that go unreported, we'll see a much larger picture of just what a problem this is in our society.
Well, Connie, thank you for coming on to talk about it. Thank you to Alison Morris as well. And remember, we do have that BBC Action Line website. Take one last call before the end of the show. Back to our top story, back to Casement. Wayne and Warren Point, you've got about 30 seconds. Oh, he's gone. We'll go to Sean and Ballymena.
How you doing, Mark? Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Just in relation to Casement, I mean, there's been a few things come up. There is a plan sitting there. As you have said, the original plan that was put in place, it's there. It's ready to go. It's for a 34,000-seater stadium. It's ready to go. The costs were due to the upgrade to UEFA. So the plan is sitting there. So that's a smokescreen to say that there's not a plan. There is a plan sitting there. He just maybe doesn't understand, but it is sitting there. It's ready to go. The funding's required for that. But the other thing is that, you know, you were mentioning earlier on about car parking. But I manage an athletic stadium in Dublin, Morton Stadium, which was the biggest athletic stadium. No car parking there, none in Croke Park, none in Aviva, none in Windsor Park, none in Ravenhill. It's government policy not to put car parking into stadiums now. They want people to use public transport, go there, they go green, that's what they want them to do. This is why. So this is another smokescreen thrown up. The other one then, of course, is the issue about usage of it. People say, oh, it's only going to be full 2-3 times a year.
Oh, sure. That's a whole can of worms. What's the weather like in Ballymena?
Not bad.
Because we want to talk about the weather. We want to cheer everybody up. It's been quite a heavy show for understandable reasons, a lot of serious issues. But the sun is out at the end of September. Jeff Maskell, what is going on?
Well, I've put some extra coins in the meter, obviously. We did some of my best work here, Mark. It is a beautiful... It's the week we've been waiting for, really, all summer. And we've actually just got a what we call a blocking high, a decent, well-established bit of high pressure sitting over Ireland. And what that means is clear skies and plenty of sunshine. And it's such a contrast to the summer. I had a little look through some of the stats while I was waiting for you. It was a cooler than average summer. For Manor and Tyrone, a whole degree cooler than average. And then it was also wetter, 129% of the average rainfall through the summer. That's almost a third more than we would normally get. And when you consider that Down and Antrim were drier than average, where it was wet, it was really wet. But the real kicker, only 82% of the sunshine that we'd expect through the sunshine. So a really dull summer. And I know because the barbecue index said, I only got the barbecue out just the once this summer. But I'm off to dust it off. I'm out to the garden now. It's going to get fired up in the next couple of days because it's going to be lovely as we head towards the weekend.
The barbecue is going to make a comeback. And the final question in 10 seconds, how long is it going to last?
It lasts through till the weekend. You can make your plans with a good degree of confidence through until about Sunday afternoon.
Jeff Maskell, thank you very much indeed. The sun shines every day that Connor Phillips is on the radio. He's next, but let's have a bit of sunshine music before we go.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream, in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.